Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with producer Jason DeFilippo. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most brilliant and interesting people and turn their wisdom into practical advice that you can use to impact your own life and those around you. And today, we've got my friend David Roski. He's the fourth person ever to successfully climb Everest and another 8,000-meter peak without oxygen in the same season. So I don't know why, and I ask him on the show why he does this, why he climbs without oxygen, as if climbing's not hard enough. Basically, one day in 2007, he goes, I'm going to get my health in order. Now he's a mountaineer, alpinist, pilot, runner, summited Everest twice, other mountain names I can't even pronounce, Broad Peak, no bottled oxygen. This is a guy also, oh, by the way, plant-powered, so it's just, for me, kind of unbelievable to be doing all that. Like, why are you making this stuff even harder than it already is? He's obviously a guy who likes to try things out of his league. He's been attempting things out of his league for a while. There's something about the sting of failure with this guy, you know? And he's got this story about himself that he's doggedly determined. He's just going to put his head down. And I met him because he was at a party, and I was in charge of the door. And I tell the story in the beginning of the show. I was in charge of the door. He basically sprinted up multiple flights of stairs in a New York walk-up. And I just thought, it seemed impossible to me that he could have gotten up that quickly. He wasn't even sweating or breathing hard.
Sounds like meth to me.
Yeah. He just doesn't. He looks the mountaineer part more so than the meth part.
But he has his teeth, man, then.
He does, yes. And his focus, his hard work. I mean, he's also like a hedge fund manager, so it's really incredible what this guy does. I mean, he is just all around a high performer. Big goals are a topic here, ambitious goals, jumping out of your comfort zone in a way that's obviously not cliche, because this guy puts his nose to the grindstone and actually gets it done. What I liked about this especially was that getting the summit is not the end of the journey. It's actually kind of a new beginning, and he just pushes his goal even higher. I'm really impressed with this cat, proud to be friends with him. And if you want to know how I managed to meet all these great people, it's at events, the curated events, and I talk about that in our 6-minute networking course, which is free over at jordanharbinger.com/course. And by the way, most of the guests here on the show actually subscribe to the course in the newsletter, so come join us. You'll be in great company. All right, here's David Roski. I'm looking at this picture of you that my wife threw in the notes, and you look like you just got out of like a North Korean re-education camp.
Yes, yeah. Right.
So give me a bit of a feel for like your physical makeup. Like, you're always a thin guy sort of wired for climbing, or what?
No, I don't think so. In fact, I was not a athlete in high school. I was not an athlete in college. I would occasionally go to the gym, and mm-hmm. that would be a very short-lived endeavor. I wasn't overweight, but I was not like an athlete at mm-hmm. all. And even through my first job out of college, several years working in LA, I was just kind of going to work and being a finance guy and not super committed to fitness. Actually had a very critical turning point where I made a decision to make a lifelong commitment to that. But so I was not always built for climbing. I did like hiking. I grew up in Colorado, mm-hmm. and so I maybe had a little bit of something in there. But I was actually going to pull up that picture too.
Yeah, sort of just got out of a North Korean prison selfie.
Yeah,
situation.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. So that was the effect of about a month from 18,000 feet to 29,000 feet, no supplemental oxygen, climbing to 8,000 meter peaks. And no matter how much you try, your body is just going to cannibalize itself. And it prefers to eat muscle as opposed to eating food. So you try to eat as much as you can. Your appetite is suppressed. And you come out the backside, and I think I was 134 pounds or something.
Oh, man. And how tall are you?
I'm 6 foot.
Yeah, so that's not... you're supposed to be 40 pounds heavier, or 30.
Yeah, so I at least lost 20, 25 pounds during that one-month stretch, and came back with extremely depleted batteries. But so I do not normally look like that picture.
Yeah.
But after each one of these 8,000 meter expeditions, I lose between 15 and 25 pounds. So I tend to come back looking like a starvation.
Yeah, yeah. Like it's
you have this beard, so it really does look like a POW kind of situation, because the beard and then your ribs are all showing and everything. And we'll throw the photo in the show notes. I mean, it's exactly what you would imagine this photo looks like. You said your appetite's suppressed. Why does that happen?
So there's something about the altitude. I think your body just goes strictly into a survival mode. Mm-hmm. And I haven't read a ton about the physiology of it, but I think that it finds it easier to consume calories that are in the form of your muscle than to, or fat, than to digest calories. Now, you are eating as much as possible, but then the other thing is just the calorie debt. So I think you're easily burning, you know, 2 or 3 times the calories a day as what you can put in.
Wow. So how do you have any idea, any estimate of how many calories that might be? Like, are you burning 10,000 calories a day or something like that?
You know, it's actually a great question, and I suppose I could back into it. I did a workout a couple nights ago for 3 hours. Which I would say is at the intensity that I am hiking for 3 to 6 hours on average on a day, not a summit day, but just an average day. And I have to pull up the picture from my phone, but I think it's like 3,500 calories right there. And that's a 3 hour hike. And moving from one camp to another on Everest, for example, is sort of a minimum of 3 hours usually. And on easy days where you're just moving up to another camp to climb it a little bit and then coming down, it's usually that, you know, 3 to 4 hours up to this next camp. You either sleep there that night or you come back down. So that's another few hours. And then it's just your basal metabolism has to be way higher. Mm-hmm. So I think 6 to 10,000 calories a day could be quite easy to burn. And then those are on the normal days. You have rest days in between, so those are going to be a little lower, but still elevated basal metabolism. And then on summit day, that's like you start at midnight after a few hours of sleep, and you know, you might be back sometime the next afternoon if you want to keep coming down, which is the safe thing to do. But I've usually been lazy and not come down. So the summit days could be many, many more thousands of calories. So I think even though your appetite is suppressed, it's still, it would be impossible to consume enough food during those days. So you're just burning.
And what do you eat when you're on a mountain? Just bars, right? And like liquid gel stuff?
You know, not a ton of that. I bring those things as snacks in base camp. And an interesting twist on this is I'm actually vegetarian, which changes the food consumption.
That to me is like, you're just adding that in there to be, it's like, what are you doing? Why?
That is true. On the other hand, I think it has saved me from many episodes of food poisoning. So when you think the meat that's either carried in on a yak to base camp, or the goat that's slaughtered, that walks itself in and then is slaughtered at base camp, and the hygiene standards in Tibet or Pakistan, they're not the same as down the street here at a grade A restaurant in New York City.
And a goat walking into a base camp has probably been eating like mountain garbage for a year, for its whole life.
Yeah. Even. So I've been extremely fortunate not to have any severe food poisoning on any of the expeditions I've taken. I'm guessing that that's partly because of only eating... I'm not a vegan, but vegetarian, only eating vegetarian foods, I think has helped. But yeah, so that's an additional challenge. But you're saying, what am I eating?
Yeah.
You know, in camp, it's very simple and plain, unfortunately, and that contributes to the lack of enough calorie intake. But it might be some cheap cereal that was, you know, that's local. So some weird cornflakes or Cocoa Puffs.
I would not imagine that you're eating like low quality
food. Low quality. Well, you know, you can go for super expensive outfitters and they might bring in Western food. I've not gone that path. And so it's like white rice, lentils, some what they'll usually call dal there, a bunch of eggs, and maybe some tomatoes. And that sort of routine seems to be played over many, many times. So when I come back from a month on that diet, the mere sight of a tomato omelet is just, my stomach
can't do
turns.
It.
And it's white rice. I'm used to like brown rice. I'm used to whole wheat bread. I'm used to whole plant foods. That's my normal diet. So it's a struggle. On the mountain, on a summit attempt or something, it's pretty simple. You have some freeze-dried, easily reconstituted, for me to be some pasta, you know, backpacking ration, and some oatmeal, instant oatmeal. And those are not high calorie. It's 150 calories a pack.
Yeah, I'm so surprised. I figured you guys were surviving on like really calorie-dense sort of marathon runner food bars. You know, you have a backpack full of just hundreds of these little, I don't know, Quest bars or something, but it's not.
So it actually turns out that relying too much on those simple sugars, which will help you get through a marathon, that's not the optimal approach for an expedition. And what you really want is to develop a fat burning metabolism up there. You're warmer when you're burning fat. You're less likely to bonk, sort of hit an energy wall, and that energy source can last on those 15-hour days, where in a marathon, you know, 2-3 hours of running, you run out of glycogen, and your body can't process. If you keep on taking gels in, you need water when you do that. So that's actually, the bars and gels, I really don't even, I might bring a couple gels, I don't subsist on them, and the bars are just snacks in base camp.
So you got to get nutrition before you even get to the mountain.
Yeah.
You got to bring it in your body.
Right.
Wow. I never thought about that. But you can't bring too much. You can't pack like me, or you're not going to make it up the mountain. You got to have that balance, right? It's got to be like quality, right? You can't just have a bunch of love handles you're hoping to work off when you get there.
Ideally not, though. I've been really impressed now. Most of us don't have the genetic makeup of a Sherpa, but I've met Sherpa who come into the beginning of an expedition with a real belly, and because they aren't affected by the altitude as much as most of us, by the end of the expedition, they've just burned all that off, and that's actually pretty ideal. That's great,
yeah,
because they're already able to, you know, hike nonstop for hours, so it's no problem for them. But
so tell us who the Sherpas are, because I think a lot of people have heard that, but they think it's the guy that carries your luggage.
Yeah, that would be just simply a porter.
Yeah.
But a Sherpa is an ethnicity, strictly from Nepal, and they've grown up for many generations in high mountains, and I believe they do have a genetic gift for performing at altitude.
Yeah.
So
even if they didn't, if they're born there, they're going to develop lung capacity over 20, 30 years
exactly.
or however.
I think that's correct. If you're born at in Leadville, Colorado at 10,000 feet and all the time you're going between 10 and climbing the 14ers around there, you're probably going to do a lot better at altitude, than other people, even if you aren't really an athlete. So you actually see a lot of Sherpa who aren't really athletes, but you don't have to be an athlete if you can just keep hiking with a heavy pack for hours and hours.
Yeah.
If you can do that, you can be very effective on the mountain.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think even if you spent a summer in Breckenridge or something like that, you're going to start to adapt pretty quick.
Right.
Because once you get past the initial headaches or whatever it is from altitude, I experienced that for the first time. I think it was in Breckenridge, and I just went, oh, this is miserable.
Yeah.
And the first day I was fine. All my friends were sick, and I was like, ah, you wimps. And then I had a couple drinks, and then the next day I was like, I am miserable. This is awful. This is the worst feeling ever. It's like a combination of a hangover and a headache that you would have with a fever without being hot, and you're tired,
right?
And it just doesn't end.
Well, alcohol is definitely the worst thing on there.
I was like, I can drink. I'm fine.
It goes to your head a lot faster when you're at altitude.
Mm-hmm.
But dehydration is one of the principal kind of compounding factors in altitude sickness. And if you're drinking alcohol, you're getting even more dehydrated. The one interesting aspect of the acclimatization phase is you have to drink excessive amounts of water. So when I'm moving up, it's in the initial part of an expedition, going to the first, you know, base camps, and I've been at sea level all the time before, I'm drinking 6 to 8 liters of water a day.
Oh, that's a ton. Cause I drink probably 2 or 3 and I'm going to the bathroom all the time.
Right.
And my friends are like, you drink more than anyone I know. So if you're drinking 2 to 3 times that, yeah,
it's the only way.
You got to force yourself to do that. Cause you're not, there's no human that's thirsty that often who doesn't have like a diabetes or like a kidney issue.
Yeah. You're just slamming that water. There's no other way to get yourself, acclimated.
Wow.
You're listening to the Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, David Roski. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored in part by HostGator.
Who are you? What's your story? Where are you telling that story? Relying on the free options offered by social media is like writing the chapters of your life in the sand. When the tide turns, as it did when MySpace recently lost 12 years of user data, these chapters will wash away, gone forever. Wouldn't it be nice if you were in complete control of your own archive of memories, safely away from the fickle tides of someone else's incompetence? Get your own website with the guiding hand of HostGator, and you can be. HostGator has outlasted your favorite social media sites of yesteryear and is likely to outlast the ones you consider unstoppable today. But even if HostGator were to go extinct tomorrow, your website's data remains yours to transfer forever as you see fit. This is why we recommend HostGator for creating and maintaining your best possible online presence. You don't have to know the first thing about programming or design in order to custom craft your own mobile-friendly website, thanks to HostGator's simple drag-and-drop builder. Choose from hundreds of themes to effortlessly switch up your presentation as you see fit, or run it all on WordPress with one easy click. Gauge your site's performance with analytics that don't take a cryptographer to decode. Stay engaged with your audience across the entire social media landscape. Accept payments directly from customers and trumpet your presence to the world's most used search engines with HostGator's arsenal of tools at your disposal. HostGator's 99.9% uptime guarantee and around-the-clock support ensures your website is available to the eyes of the world every day and night of the year. Got a tight budget? No worries. As long as you're a new user, you get to try any HostGator package for up to 62% off the normal price, just for hearing the sound of my voice. And if you're not completely satisfied with everything HostGator has to offer, you've got 45 days to cancel for a refund of every last penny. Check out HostGator.com/Jordan right now to sign up. That's HostGator.com/Jordan.
This episode is also sponsored by SimpliSafe. Okay, so a while ago, Jen and I wanted a security system, and we called all the usual suspects, because I thought, oh, there's got to be a bunch of new stuff out there. There wasn't. And so we had these sales guys come to our house. And I mean, they were showing me stuff that we had installed in my house in Michigan in the 90s when I was a teenager. They had the same stuff. I could not believe it. Oh, of course, they had an app that was like $20 or $30 extra per month and looked like somebody coded it in about 7 minutes in 2007. So I was not impressed. Then we found out about SimpliSafe, and this is the 21st century home security system. It's crazy that only 1 in 5 homes have home security. A lot of people only have like a camera out in the front door. It's like, people break windows. Hello. SimpliSafe is a top choice, hands down. They've got door sensors, window sensors. They protect every door, every window with 24/7 professional monitoring. It's not just going to beep and then you've got to get a little push notification on your phone. You know, it calls their monitoring center. They make it easy on you. There's no contract. There's no hidden fees. It's won a ton of awards, and it's around the clock monitoring, $15 a month. One thing that they have that is amazing, they've got video verification technology. So a lot of security systems ring, it's a false alarm. Police generally assume a home security system alarm is a false alarm. What SimpliSafe does is they are able to visually confirm that the break-in is happening. Then they say, hey, cops, there is someone in the house that's not supposed to be there. They'll get to the scene 3.5 times faster than other security systems. That is kind of worth its weight in gold if you're sitting upstairs with your wife and kid and there's somebody downstairs with a crowbar, right, Jason?
Visit simplisafe.com/Jordan. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure you go to simplisafe.com/Jordan so they know our show sent you. That's SimpliSafe.com/Jordan. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard from our amazing sponsors, visit JordanHarbinger.com/deals. And don't forget, we have a worksheet for today's episode so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of all the key takeaways from David Roski. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Subscribing to the show is absolutely free. It just means that you get all the latest episodes in your podcast player when they're released, so you don't miss a single thing from the show. And now back to our episode with David Roski.
How long does it take to climb some of these mountains? Like, I think people don't really get that these are really long expeditions, because everybody else has done maybe like, they think, oh, it's a 4-day weekend. We're going to go up K2 and come back down. See you guys on Tuesday.
Right. I actually do get that reaction when I tell people. They're like, how long are you going? I'll say I'm going on this next expedition. I'm like, well, I'm going to be gone for, you know, the month of July. And they're like, what?
Well, are you throwing a vacation in there? Or,
yeah. Right. Yeah. But that's actually pretty short. So most people going on an Everest expedition, that's like a 6 to 8 week thing. I just can't take that much time off. So I guess I've been lucky that my body's been able to handle, but I've done all my expeditions on basically a 5 week timeline, 4 to 5 week. And that's, I think, pushing the edge of, you know, the limits of human acclimatization right up to the limit.
Yeah. And the reason you can't take that time off is because what's even more kind of insane, we were talking about this before the show, is that you're an investment manager in New York City. So it's not like you are training all day and sleeping all day and going there and getting used to the food and the water and the altitude and the air or the whatever.
Right.
You are just getting off a plane and kind of like, got to do this.
Yeah, that's totally true. I'm not a professional climber. I'm an amateur with big goals, essentially, that I've pursued. And I really enjoy actually having a balance between going out, and I absolutely love the mountains. I love climbing them, but that's not all that I want to do in life. Mm-hmm. So I have a finance job in New York City and try to pick stocks by day and manage money for endowments, pension funds, and make good long-term decisions for our investors. And then every once in a while, I'm super fortunate that I've been able to go off and try to push my own physical limits as hard as I can.
You say you're not a professional climber, but I think people go, oh, well, that's why not? You're the fourth person ever to successfully climb Everest and another 8,000 meter peak. Also, by the way, without oxygen in the same season. So saying you're not professional, I don't want people to get the idea that, like, oh, there's so many people, like, you can't cut it in the climbing world. It's just that you also do other things. Because I think if someone says, oh, I'm not a professional football player, it's like, okay, well, you're just not good enough to play professional football. This is kind of a different scenario.
Yeah. Now, after I was that fourth person, then a true mountain god, Kilian Jornet, came and did the same thing. Actually the same combination of peaks, Cho-Yu, which is the sixth highest mountain, and then Everest. And he is a true professional. I have a regular job, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then I have had really big goals that have developed over time in the mountains, but I don't make any money off of the climbs. And in a way, I think I'm really fortunate. I think now people who want to spend their whole life in the mountains, they need to make a career of it. But I like not having the pressure of climbing for the sake of my sustenance. So getting to the top of a peak or making it up a new route is not a motivation for me being out there. It's simply for the love of the mountains and the love of the entire experience that goes into it. And so I feel relieved that, and it's extremely dangerous. It's hard enough to face the danger without the pressure of performing in order to
make
money.
It keeps you a little bit safer because you're not like, oh, well, if Alex Honnold is going to free solo El Cap, I got to do something even more dangerous to get the limelight so I can get a sponsorship.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I haven't had to push to do things that I might not be purely motivated to do on my own just for the sake of sponsorship.
Yeah, that's possibly a life-saving thing in an industry where you're constantly cutting.
Right.
Not cutting corners, but doing something a little bit more dangerous than last time.
Right.
Which is not always a good idea.
or there's just, there's certain unavoidable risks to the sport of mountaineering, and you're always sort of running along a line of something that's much more dangerous than most activities.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you train with a nine to five? We're in Manhattan, so it's never 9 to 5, but how are you training with a day job? Because you can't just like take off at 4:30 and go to the mountain. There's right. No mountain.
No. Yeah. I think that's, it's kind of one of the cool things about, the balance of goals that I have is just having to figure out how to pursue them with the tools I have, right here and right now. I certainly can't say that New York City is the ideal place to train for mountains.
Probably not, no.
By a long shot. But I think a little bit of a lesson in it is anyone going after big goals, you can always just start with something, with what you have here. And what I happen to have here is I live in a building that has 40 stories. So I hike the stairs with a backpack on, and I do that for hours at a time. I also go to the gym and just turn up the incline to the steepest it'll go. And I did this just 2 nights ago. I spent 3 hours on a treadmill, and it was one of the, most treadmills go to 15%. This one I found went to 30% incline, and I put a 30-pound barbell in my backpack and hiked that for 3 hours. And this was after a full day of work. Now I'd have to cut out a lot of other things. And, you know, I think some of the other guests that you've had on and some of the other books that you recommend talk a lot about pairing non-essential things from your life.
Sure, yeah.
And that's certainly been absolutely a requirement for me to do, I think, to perform well at a demanding job and try to pursue athletic goals that are also very demanding and require your best performance or your life is on the line. It's required cutting out other things. But if I don't have too much else going on, I can have a full day at work and be focused and productive. And then I can go to the gym. And I think I was on the treadmill till 10 or 10:30.
Oh, man.
Went home, you know, got some food, but and went to sleep. But the other great thing is while I'm on that treadmill, I'm listening to books and podcasts. So I'm feeding my brain, which is also useful for my job. So I don't feel like I'm even taking away from my work. I'm able to educate my brain while I'm doing this work. So I've found a way with just the very simple tools I have here at sea level to train for big mountains.
I think one of the reasons that we met, well, we met at our friend John Levy's party, but I was doing something with the door at this party. And it was like, John said, hey, when they buzz, just sort of pay attention because like 5 minutes later, they're going to be up the stairs and let's walk up, or 4 minutes later or 3 minutes later or whatever it was. And so it would be like buzz and I'd go like, all right, I'm going to go make a drink and then go to the door. And then it would
right.
be like, buzz. And then I'd finish my conversation and go to the door. And then when I met you, it was like buzz. And then it was like, tung, tung, tung. And I was like, wait a minute. Did I just have a brain fart where I lost 3 minutes of my life? Like, what happened? So I opened the door and I thought, oh, maybe someone else buzzed and you right. happened to already be on the stairs. So I was waiting, waiting, waiting. Nobody else came in. And then finally I went, hey, how did you get up here so fast? And you're like, oh, I just ran. But you're not breathing heavy. You're wearing a white shirt. You're not sweating. How the hell did you do that? Because it was like 6 flights of stairs.
Right.
And then that's how we got to talking, that you just run upstairs.
Now I remember this. I had actually forgotten that. But
yeah, because you probably do it everywhere.
It is, you know, I am kind of lazy. Sometimes I go home. In fact, most of the time I go home to my building and I take that elevator to the 12th floor. And,
well, yeah, after a 3 hour treadmill.
And I'm like, you know, I could add on another 12 floors, but I'm like, meh, I'll just go. So
it's 11 p.m. Yes. I'm hungry and I just got off a treadmill. Right. So I'm going to take the elevator. I think that's forgivable.
Thank you. Yeah. I know some people that have more dedication than I do, but I have enough. But yeah, I actually have found in this whole process, backing up to that story about getting fit and choosing to get into fitness, which was not until I was 26 years old did I make this conscious decision, all right, I'm going to invest in my body on a frequent, like near daily basis, because that's I want that for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And that really led to all of the other things that I've done since then. At first, I was just working out weightlifting, and then I ended up entering a race here with the New York Roadrunners, and I found, oh, that 4 mile race was really fun. Mm-hmm. And let me try that again. And then I got a little bit better, and I was like, wow, that growth, that improvement from whatever place I was to that next place, that was really fun. I want to keep that going. And then that became a passion. So it wasn't until I was actually 32 that I got the inspiration to pick up high altitude mountaineering. But by then I had been running for, I guess, 6 years, and I'd run the marathon in New York a few times. So I had this base of fitness.
You finished the marathon in like 2:38 though, right? I mean, you're doing it pretty quick.
Now I've gotten it down to 2:34, 2:35. I didn't start. I started from, I will say I probably had a, some natural ability, but it was not
developed. Like a runner's build type situation.
Yeah. My first races were probably faster than average, but it was all a development thing. But so I had that base of fitness. And then in this, as I started getting into mountain climbing, then I realized, oh, the stairs are kind of interesting. And I'd heard about the Empire State Building run up, which is a race upstairs. And after 5 or 6 years of running, I decided to enter that. And so, but when we met, I had already been doing those for a while. And now I do the run up One World Trade Center and Empire State Building and a few others. And they're taking that six flight hike that you met me on mm-hmm. to 88 or 104.
Oh, how do you, there can't be that many people on a set of stairs though. So is it like, hey, if you're slow, go to the right, and if you're running up, go to the left kind of situation?
What they do is they figure out where you should essentially start based on prior experience. So mm-hmm. if it's your first stair race, they'll start you in the back. And then it's chip timed, and they only release like one person every 5 to 10 seconds. So a stair race can take all morning, 3 or 4 hours, because they can't let everyone start at once.
Yeah.
But then it's just your timing is just the net timing from when you cross the mat at the beginning to the top.
That seems like a better and safer way. Because I'm imagining people running up and bumping into each other. Or like somebody slows down and it's like, now I'm stuck. Or
There's no true jam, but you like you do overtake people if you got placed a little bit behind them. And mm-hmm. You're actually on the rail. So a huge benefit is pulling on the rail with your arms. You want both arms and legs. And so you end up kind of sliding up underneath the person. If they are polite, they'll hop to the left. They'll get off the rail and let you pull through.
Yeah, that makes sense.
In a pretty competitive race. And if you're kind of neck and neck, they might try to make you actually go out around.
That's so annoying.
Let go.
That's got to be so irritating. Move.
Yeah, right. But you don't even quite have the... You don't want to waste the breath to tell them to move.
Right.
But you do say something like coming through, and I often, like, my hands are like slipping up underneath, but eventually people will let you.
You need like a belt with a button that you can push that says move, or a little horn.
Yeah.
Like an air horn belt. Yeah, that has to exist. If not, you know, feel free to run
for that huge market. Yeah, this is a pretty niche, somewhat dorky sport. I'd say.
Yeah, it's very New York. Like maybe in any big city you can find a skyscraper, but You can't really do this in Troy, Michigan or whatever.
Probably not.
So you're taking 5 weeks off work, but everybody else who's doing this is doing these mountains in 7-8 weeks.
Yeah.
So you're doing it in a month and change, maybe. Right. They're doing it in 2 full months. So you get there and they're already like, yeah, I'm acclimated. Right. I'm warmed up. Right. I've already started eating yak butter or whatever the hell.
Yeah. That is true. I've always come in a little later. So I'm actually preparing to go on a second attempt on K2 in a couple weeks here, and I'm watching on Instagram and I'm seeing all these people who have just begun arriving in base camp, and so that makes me antsy on the one hand, but I know I wouldn't get the opportunity to go at all if I was taking more time off, and I'm actually trying to keep it under a month this year, because I tried last year and it's kind of hard to ask for a big trip like this 2 years in a row
from my
work. So if I can just go and give it a shot, I will, and I'm going to turn around if it's unsafe. But I also think there is some benefit to coming in a little bit later and spending less time. So you have two curves you're trying to optimize for. You have your acclimatization, which is improving when you're there, but you also have your fitness, which is rapidly declining. And so just when you're up there at altitude, you're not doing those great workouts every day. You're climbing to a new camp one day, you come back down and you rest a couple days, and you have no interest in doing push-ups and, like, you know, sprints around your camp. That's not happening.
And you wouldn't even want to, right? Because you're just burning the storage that you brought with you.
Yeah. So you have zero, so you just sit around, you talk to people, you play some cards, whatever, but you're not exercising except when you're moving to those camps. So during that period of time, you're getting out of shape. And so what you ideally want is, by the time you're just acclimated enough to climb the mountain, you haven't lost too much fitness to no longer have the fitness.
So there's definitely a window, not even to mention the seasonal window,
right?
Because you can't just go, hey, I got Christmas off, let me go climb a mountain.
Right.
No, there's 20 feet of snow.
Yeah, there's literally a few days, and that's one of the things we saw this year on Everest with all the tragedies, the people who died there. The weather window was very narrow, and everybody was trying to jam up into that, and that caused those crazy traffic lines.
Yeah, explain what that was, because I think I probably saw it on your Instagram, or maybe I was just researching you for this, and I saw this, and it was like a huge line.
Right.
I mean, it looked like Black Friday on a mountain.
Yeah.
There was just people are touching each other and just sitting down on a mountain that you're probably not supposed to hang out on for too long.
Definitely not. I mean, it's kind of depressing, really, to look at those pictures. One, for the safety aspect. Two, for just it feels like it cheapens the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But also, people up there, when you're in that position, like, you are gradually dying, essentially, because those pictures were taken in the death zone. And
I want to hear about what that is in a second.
The longer you spend there, the more danger you're in. And because of the altitude, even the people that are on oxygen, which a lot of the people there just probably shouldn't have been there. So regardless of how much oxygen they were on, but it becomes this compounding, like a whole like one little thing goes wrong. Somebody's sick. They're tied into the line. The people behind aren't skilled enough to walk around them, so then they're held up. Then somebody else who isn't sick, just because of exposure, gets sick, altitude sick. So all of that combined to create some of those the tragic deaths that happened this year.
Tied into the line, so is there like a rope keeping you from falling off, essentially? Is that what that is?
So for most of the climbers doing Everest these days, they're going up a fixed rope that's put in by an advanced team of usually a mix of Sherpa and some Western climbing guides. And so at the beginning of the season, they put a new rope up, and then everybody simply hikes along that with an ascender. So it's not real mountaineering. It's not climbing, really. Everest isn't that much to do with climbing. It's mostly just hiking, but there's a lot of exposure. And so you're at great risk if you do take your ascender, this Jumar thing that slides up the rope, and it's attached to your harness. So you keep walking and you slide that up a little bit each time you take a step. It's dangerous when you unclip that, because now there's nothing there if you were to trip.
Oh, God.
And so nobody wants to let go. And
right.
No one wants to let you pass either. And so just...
Why don't they want to let you pass? Like the competitive kind of thing, or they think you're going to hold them up later. Maybe
there is a bit of when you're up at that level. I think the intensity of the situation pushes everyone to a little bit of a survival mentality, mm-hmm. of I have to protect myself first at all costs, and whether that's your ability to get to the mountain, you know, a minute before the next person, or anything else. That's why you do see a lot of what seems like inhumane behavior up there, where people become very apparently selfish on the mountain. That's a whole nother thing that we should probably talk about.
Yeah.
But keep going.
I was curious because on that note, that's this David Sharp controversy, and I guess he was freezing to death, or maybe he was just dying of exposure, altitude, whatever,
right.
And like 40 people, literally 40 right. people passed him,
yeah.
and then he ended up dying, and people were like, whoa,
right.
what are we doing here?
Yeah.
This guy died, easily could have been helped by
right.
dozens of people and
right.
wasn't.
Right. So that's a, it's not quite a moral dilemma, but it's a challenging situation for a lot of people when they get there, because one, they know that if they expend any extra energy, their own life is partly at risk. Whether they think of it that way, it's just instinctual. Two, they've put a lot of work into getting there and money, and so they're just pure selfishness. They're like, this guy, if he shouldn't have been there, that's his fault. And so you see what appears to be incredibly distasteful human behavior up there. And I think the only way you don't act in that manner is if you've made a decision ahead of time about how you're going to act when someone is in need around you. And then the other complicating factor is those psychological studies we've seen where if there's a group, there's a dilution of your feeling of responsibility.
Yeah, like the bystander effect.
The bystander effect.
You see that in New York City all the time. Someone passed it on the sidewalk and people are stepping over them. And it's like,
somebody else is going to help that.
Yeah.
I don't need to do it. And so I think that probably adds on to all of those other factors. And so if you're the only person there, then maybe at least a higher percentage of those people walking over the sick body would have helped. You put them already in their oxygen-addled brain state. The fact that a lot of them have sunk their entire life savings into being there, and they don't want this guy's life to get in the way of their son.
Oh, man.
So I think that you have to decide ahead of time. And the only way to react in the ethical way is to decide ahead of time.
Like before you get to the mountain
and throughout your life. It has to be a practice, like that famous quotation, you don't rise to the level of expectations, you fall to the level of your training, or you fall to the level of the values that you've lived the rest of your life. Those values have to be at the core of your identity. Otherwise, in that extreme of a situation, you're going to be like all those other people. So a lot of people look at those pictures and think, oh my God, how could all these people walk by?
Right.
And those are those same people. Like if they were on the mountain, they would be that person.
Because in the moment you go, oh, I'm so close. So there's people behind me. They'll help him.
And this guy's already. What can I do? How can I help him? Maybe he's already gone.
Yeah. He's fine. He's just taking a break. There's all these rationalizations that
happen.
Right. Yeah, he's not that sick. He'll be fine in a few minutes.
Right.
After I can't see him anymore.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But you must have made that decision before, because you mentioned you're making a second attempt at K2.
Yes.
I remember talking with you, I guess last year or the year before or something like that. What happened on the first attempt? Because you had already made that decision, and then you kind of had to, you had to put your money where your mouth is.
Right.
Literally, I guess, at that
point. Which, it's very interesting, because I had been talking about the lessons that I had hoped I had learned from climbing other mountains. And one of the big lessons that I'd said I wanted to learn was to put people first.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd actually been a beneficiary where someone let me squeeze into their tent at 25,000 feet on Everest when the wind was too strong to pitch a tent for myself. And it wasn't a survival situation, but it was a urgent situation. I could have hiked back down in the dark, but a bunch of people in their tents said, you can't stay with us.
Too dangerous.
Figure it out yourself.
Oh, they said no.
They said no.
Oh, I feel like I could not live with myself being like, get out of here. I just couldn't do it.
So they said no. And then this one guy said, yeah, there's two of us in here, but you can squeeze in, even though it's, a real inconvenience. And that was incredibly kind of him. And so I saw that. And when I got done with that trip, I thought, wow, that's the way to live.
Mm-hmm.
You want to put people first above all else. And I kept telling people that, but what good is it if I didn't live it out myself?
Right. People first, as long as it's me, but if it's somebody else, sorry, buddy.
Right.
Yeah.
So last year I was trying to do, another doubleheader. I do Broad Peak, which is the 12th highest mountain, and then K2 there in Pakistan, both without oxygen. And on my first run up the mountain for a summit attempt, my partner and I were at the highest camp, and it was really interesting. We we had slept the night before. We were planning to rest a day and then go for it. We woke up in the morning and there were some other people coming into camp and or packing up their tent site. So we got out and started talking to them and said, "Hey, what's up?" They're like, "Yeah, we, you know, we had come up here. We were going to try to make a summit attempt. One of our partners went off on his own to go for the summit. We decided not to. He didn't come back. We'd been waiting for him. We saw him at one point, but then he disappeared on the mountain. We think he fell into a crevasse or he fell off. And we've been waiting here for, I don't know, 24, 36 hours. And they thought he's done. And so they were packing up and going to go down.
They were just going to leave?
They did.
They left?
They left.
Oh, those are some friends. Well, I guess, I don't know. But what do you do?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, rough, you know, rough situation to be in and clearly very sobering. So, my climbing partner and I were just like, wow, well, you know, that's intense. And we're just still there. Like, what? There's nothing else to do. But later in that evening, that was in the morning, later that evening, we got a radio call. And the radio call said, well, someone at base camp was just randomly looking through a telescope and saw someone moving up on the mountain slope. And then they sent a drone up and they found the guy that had been presumed lost.
Oh, man. He's just wandering around
and,
lost.
And he was out on a glacier and not tied into anything, by himself. And there's crevasses and he's alive. So it's moving.
If you're in that situation, is that one of those, like, it's not a matter of if, but when you just fall to your death? Because if you're not roped in, you kind of don't know where you are. That's got to be about the most dangerous.
It's highly dangerous
situation.
I personally think he made a very bad decision to go off by himself.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't follow that logic at all.
I fully disagree with that decision on his part, but it was a dangerous place for him. There was probably not, there was a decent chance he could have made his way back without falling in, but there's a video that, I don't know if you saw, but there's a YouTube video that was taken by the drone pilot, which shows both me and my partner. So the drone ended up going up and down the mountain. They had to wait to recharge it, but it helped guide us to this climber.
Oh,
man. It was a 63-year-old guy who had a lot of experience mountaineering. Pretty old school, didn't carry a radio or satellite communicator.
That's really dumb. I get it. You're older. You didn't grow up doing that. But like, it's like
new responsibilities for new times.
Yeah. And you're alone.
Right.
So I get it. You're with a group. Your friend has the radio. You should probably still carry one. But if you're alone, just humor me on this one and take a radio.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Totally.
Ugh, irritating.
So, they ended up using the drone to lead us to him. And my climbing partner and I, it took a while. We went down. Directions were wrong. We had to hike back up to the camp, Camp 3 on Broad Peak. And then we went up a little higher and tied in and went across this glacier and found him. And with now we're roped together, which now if somebody falls into a crevasse, the other people can fall on their ice axe and save them. So
you have to, that's like the movie scene where you whip your ice hammer out and
fall on the head. If the person on the other end of the rope falls into something, you fall to the ground in a self-arrest position. And
I don't have the, like, I'm getting jittery thinking about, I mean, it could be the coffee, but I'm getting a full body kind of cringe feeling where I just can't. It's the same feeling I get when I hear about people drowning in a cave underwater. I'm like, I just can't think about it. Right?
Well, that gave me a bad feeling.
Yeah. Clearly you have. Okay, so you shouldn't go caving underwater. You can stick to glaciers and mountains.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, David Roski. We'll be right back after this.
This episode is sponsored in part by Bioptimizers. These guys are the Navy SEAL of probiotics. As Jason says, it's Jocko Willink for your butt. They're giving away a free trial bottle of their patented probiotic supplement. And I know patented sounds fancy, but I'll tell you, I tried this a bunch. It definitely does what it's supposed to do without getting into too many details. You probably heard me say by now that 99% of those over-the-counter probiotics, everyone's like, they colonize your gut. They don't do that. Most studies now have proven that most probiotics, they pass through your system. They don't do anything. You still do need good bacteria to fight the bad guys. It's just not going to colonize your gut. And the solution that I found is P3OM. I've been using this for, a year at least now. And you can, let's just say you can see the results in action, as it were. It's proteolytic, which means it digests protein. It's antiviral, antiretroviral, eliminates pathogens, maintainable in the digestive system. It's not meant to colonize, though. There's a difference there. And the strain doubles every 20 minutes, and then you eliminate it in 3 to 4 days. This is not... Jason, have you heard of fecal transplant? Isn't that crazy?
Oh, yeah. When you swap poop with someone?
Yep.
Yeah.
See, that's gut colonization. You're not going to get that from a supplement. But what this does better than any other strain is fight the bad guys, parasites, viruses, that kind of stuff in your gut. You get a free bottle now. Obviously, you pay the shipping. There's no cancel. It's not forced continuity BS. They offer a 365-day money-back guarantee. My friend runs this company, so it's not like shady fly-by-night internet stuff. P3OM.com/JordanFree. P3OM is in Michael.com/JordanFree. You'll get the unique coupon code to get the free bottle. Limit one per household. Valid while supplies last. You're going to love it. Let me know what you... don't let me know what comes out of this. This episode is also sponsored by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers in your business, you don't know your business. And if your wife doesn't know your numbers, you don't know your business because she manages all that. But the problem that we had early on with all of my businesses that I've run is there's always this hodgepodge of business systems, right? There's 17 different dashboards. There's an accounting dashboard, a sales dashboard, an inventory dashboard. A lot of things are run on spreadsheets because we don't have the software for that. And then you got to make sure those are reconciled. It's just a huge pain. NetSuite by Oracle is business management software that handles every aspect of the business in a cloud platform. So it gives you visibility, gives you control that you need to grow. And with NetSuite, you save time, you save money. A lot of headaches are skipped/managed with sales, finance, accounting, orders, HR instantly from your desktop. They've got a great phone app that helps you as well. Because if you're anything like me, you want to check those numbers kind of obsessively all the time. And they've got really a spectacular cloud business system. And a lot of these top brands that you know of use NetSuite. And now it's available to small and mid-sized businesses, a.k.a. you. So right now, they've got an insights guide. Jason, tell them how to grab that.
Yeah, right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/Jordan. That's netsuite.com/Jordan to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, netsuite.com/Jordan.
This episode is also sponsored in part by Progressive.
Saving money on your car insurance is easy with Progressive. It's an average savings of $699 a year for customers who switch and save. In fact, customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts on their auto policy when they switch to Progressive. Discounts for just starting a quote online or owning multiple vehicles. Get your quote online at progressive.com and see how much you could be saving. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Thank you for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers keeps us on the air. To learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard so you can check out those amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget that worksheet for today's episode. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And if you're listening to us in the Overcast player, please click that little star next to the episode. It really helps us out. And now for the conclusion of our episode with David Roski.
Okay, so you're up there
right.
Roped into this stubborn guy.
Right. Yeah, he was actually pretty stubborn, we found. He didn't really want our help. He had been without water for, 36 hours, and he was half dreaming, half hallucinating. He was telling us he would close his eyes and fall, like kind of micro dream, and he would see helicopters there to pick him up or Range Rover there to pick him up, and then he'd open his eyes and wake up and realize, oh, there's nothing here.
That's got to be the worst feeling.
It's insane. But you're so loopy at that point with the oxygen deprivation that I don't think it's even that scary, which is really weird.
That's bad for you. That's even worse for you. Because then you think, I'm fine.
Yeah. And
yeah.
So we got him back. Now we had spent a lot of energy and we brought him back to the high camp. Another team had come up by then and they took over from there in terms of melting snow and making him food and water. And they actually brought him all the way down from there the next day. But we had spent our energy. And so we gave up that particular summit attempt. And we came back down and rested a few other days, went back up and successfully got Broad Peak. But by now, we were cutting in right to the good weather window that was coming up for K2, and you need a little bit of time to recover between mountains. So my partner and I were looking at the weather forecasts, and we thought, you know, we're going to wait a little bit and we should be fine to go a little bit later. And then as we kept seeing these forecasts come in, we realized this window that's coming up right now mm-hmm. is the only window for K2. And we tried to make it up the mountain, but we got halfway and then it started snowing and we gave it up. So
that's got to be an exercise in kind of like mitigating cognitive bias, because you right. want it so bad.
Right.
But that optimism bias is what kills so many people.
Sure. Yeah. Or summit fever, or just a lack of...
What's summit fever?
Summit fever is when you see the summit or you're close enough to it where you can really taste it, and you end up... It's like that Everest movie where they kept pushing through their agreed upon turnaround times. They're like, okay, it's 2 p.m. Oh, you know, it's the weather, you know, it's only there. It's another hour. It's really probably another 2 or 3 hours mm-hmm. to the top, but you feel so close and you've put so much. It's that sunk cost.
Sunk cost, yeah.
Mentality. And so summit fever is when you keep going against all rational reason to turn around because you feel it so close.
And it's got to be the worst, especially for someone in your position, because it's not like, all right, I'm coming back in a month, or I can for sure do this next year. You have to get time off, make sure you're in the right state. Like, this is a whole, there's years of opportunity cost to save someone's life. And then on top of that, if memory serves, he was not nice to you as a result. He was like, he was pretty thankless.
He was. I think it's pretty tough on the ego to accept assistance that anyone could call a rescue. I know, I hope I'm never in the position where I have to accept that, because it means you kind of screwed up. You know, you made some bad decisions.
Better than dying.
His case, I would say bad decisions. If you're caught in an avalanche and and it's not your own, you didn't get yourself there because of a stupid decision, rescue me.
Sure.
But if you're a trained mountaineer, you don't want to be in a position where you endanger other people's lives. So I can imagine how difficult it was for him to accept the idea that we were there to help him.
Well, especially being Mr. I don't need the rest of my group I don't need a radio. No. I mean, he's already, that ego was already out of control, which is what got him there in the first place. So the fact that a bunch of like young guys had to come and rescue him and then bring him down the mountain, that was like the final kick in the guts.
Yeah. And we didn't love it. My partner, Frederick Strang, and I, we thought, man, like, we've just spent hours coming to help you, and you don't even want to take our chocolate, you know, take the warm water we brought. And you're saying you don't need help. That certainly rubbed us the wrong way,
sure.
But it really was about, knowing, hey, whatever his reaction, we did the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can sleep at any night, of your life if you know you've done the right thing.
Yeah.
Even if that person is sort of throwing it back in your face. So we left him with that other team. We came down the next day. We didn't know that this would end up delaying us on our next attempt. It was just, we were the only ones in that at that camp that could help. And that was the right decision to make.
Yeah. It's kind of like when your drunk friend wants to fight the police. You're just like, I really want to let you get arrested, but I don't want you to get arrested.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see it. Do you have like really good life insurance? Do they make life insurance?
They don't. I have tried, hey, like, I mean, this is a separate topic, but for these mountains, the risk is so great. It's very sobering to have to write up your will for your parents. And list where they're going to find stuff,
Through
that every year. It's, you do not want them to be in that position.
Yeah.
But
it's under the mattress in the guest room now,
right?
So that's not under my mattress.
You have to be responsible, though.
Yeah.
I
was asking if you got really good life insurance.
Oh, right.
But I'm wondering also, you call them and they go, oh yeah, sure, tell us what you're going to be doing, and then they're just like, you're an idiot. Click.
Yeah,
what are you doing?
No. Like, I've tried to get to that point, making the wills, etc. I've thought, if something were bad to happen, I'd want big donations to be made to my favorite charities, mm-hmm. and my parents to get something, and I haven't been able to find any life insurance policies that will accept they all have the exclusion of, like, high altitude mountaineering.
Yeah.
And so, and they're like, oh, why are you calling right now? You know, like, do you have any foreign travel planned? Like, also, are you I do a bunch of things that are on the exclusion list, like flying airplanes and stuff. So,
oh yeah, you're also a pilot flying your own airplane.
So it's just,
they're you're uninsurable, man. You're asking for it. We're not going to roll the dice on you.
I have to make good decisions up there and hope the mountain gods smile on me.
Yeah. I'm honestly, though, the most dangerous thing, and maybe this is incorrect, but I think the most dangerous thing you do is probably jogging around Manhattan. Right.
Possibly.
Because the odds of you getting hit by a car jogging, I say this tongue in cheek, but I'm not obviously hoping for that to happen. That's so much more dangerous than highly trained, highly controlled, regulated flight.
Flying, I think, is pretty safe.
Yeah.
The mountains
are dangerous.
They're very dangerous.
But jogging in a city like Manhattan is also statistically dangerous. Not that safe.
Right.
Yeah.
I've been hit by a biker in Central Park, where I thought it would be safe. It was definitely half my fault for turning too quickly. So I've experienced that here.
that's interesting. I think, the mountains, there's just no way that that's safe, especially without oxygen.
Right.
Why make it harder? That's the question, right? People go, mountaineering. And then you're like, and also I'm not bringing the thing that everyone else needs to survive.
So I did climb Everest once and I used oxygen at the end. I didn't want to. It was my first time at that high of an altitude, and I'd only been there a couple weeks. I got to the top, but I don't really count that as a real summit, and I don't want to diminish the climbs of other people who choose to use oxygen. But to me, using it is a performance-enhancing drug. It's bringing the mountain lower. Mm-hmm.
I could see
it's
that.
Essentially, you're challenging your body to climb something that would be the equivalent of, say, a 6,000 meter peak or 7,000 meter peak, not an 8,800 meter peak. And so I went back a second time because I wanted, and also not to diminish the accomplishment, but I was surprised how almost anybody with average fitness can climb Everest with oxygen.
I was wondering about that, because you see a lot of people up there now.
They're not. I thought going the first time I'd meet all these insane athletes, and then I'm like, I think I'm more fit than most of these people, just because I'm a decent runner. And there's a lot of people that it was just their life passion, and they were not that impressive as athletes. I knew that doing it without oxygen was totally different. So, some 8,000 people have summited total, and just about 200 have done it without oxygen. So that I knew was going to challenge myself to a whole nother level. And I really, one of the big aspects of climbing that I love is testing my own limits.
Sure.
And so that was kind of, hey, this is an ultimate test. I don't know if I can do it, but I'd like to try.
There's a huge rise in guy who just sold a startup paying to go to Everest and then framing a photo of him doing it.
Yeah.
And not that that's, I get that. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But it's not the same thing as doing it 50 years ago or something, which is kind of, you're kind of reenacting that challenge in a way.
Yeah. The technology today, it's nothing like the old treks, a month just to get to base camp on the Tibetan side, which is how I climbed Everest. You drive to base camp. People in Nepal are taking helicopters, which that's even more. But it's just, and then, the equipment we have today is so much lighter and warmer. So making it a little bit more, there's this idea in alpinism called fair means. And to climb a mountain by fair means is generally considered climbing without oxygen. It's also includes a bunch of other things, usually not using those fixed lines, not using Sherpa support. On a mountain like Everest that's so commercialized, it's very hard to do it in the most purest way. But doing it without oxygen was the step that kind of one of the lines that I thought I want to challenge myself to that level.
How much does it cost? 50, 70, 100 grand?
It can. I never paid that much because I didn't go with the expensive full amenity sort of Western expeditions.
Yeah, so you're carrying your own crap, not having someone carry it for you. You don't have a chef or whatever with you.
I mean, there was a cook in Advanced Base Camp still, and still had yaks carrying stuff up
You there. Have to have that, though. You can't not
like, I mean, have it, that. You could do it by yourself. It's very hard. So there's such a range. I ended up paying about $30,000, and I was able to do, for $30,000, I was able to do two mountains, Cho-Oyu and Everest, in my last expedition to that part of the world.
Are you just paying for it, or do you get like North Face or some sponsor to?
Yeah, I don't have any sponsors on that. But you could go as cheap as $10,000 or so for the most basic of permits, and the logistics operators will get you the permit, and they'll get you transportation to base camp, and then you're on your own.
Oh man.
You can get something, somewhat in the middle where you get services up to advanced base camp, but you're on your own above that. And then you have just this range. And so a lot of the numbers quoted in the press, the 80 to 120, mm-hmm. These expeditions do have great Western food. I've gone in and, you know, to their tents and drooled at that. And
yeah.
They even have like sauna tents at base camp and like a plasma TV that they truck in. And
dang.
It's just...
playing Xbox at base camp.
It's a whole different kind of experience, and that's suits some people. Now, Pakistan, the Karakoram range is a lot more wild than the Everest area, and for Pakistan, you end up needing to hike in for 60 miles. It's about a 5-day trek just to hike yourself to base camp.
Jeez.
So they're not carrying some of those amenities to base camp. It's a little more wild.
They're leaving bodies and stuff up there, right? Like I meant to ask you that before, but it seems like if you die in the mountain, there. In fact, there's like a landmark guy. He's a guy.
Yeah.
Who died, and yeah. Now he's like a milestone. Like, oh, yes. We're passing old Jimmy or whatever.
Green boots.
Green boots.
Yeah.
That's crazy to me.
You know,
it's crazy to non-climbers.
It is crazy, but because it feels like you're on the moon when you're up there, it's such a harsh and alien environment that someone that's frozen inside this cave, and you don't really see their face, but you see it's weird that it's not as weird when you add that, like on the street here, that would be absolutely
awful. Like imagine there's just a guy at Rockefeller Center that's been dead for 20 years.
No way. But when you
yeah.
when you think about, okay, you're going to the moon and someone was there, you almost feel bad about moving them because they're a part of that ecosystem, like their story lives on because of that. So I was actually very sad to hear that this famous climber that's called Green Boots, he was in a cave, they call it Green Boots Cave, on the northeast ridge of Everest, which is the traditional route from the Chinese-Tibetan side. He had been a fixture there for many years, so you pay homage almost as you go by. Mm-hmm. You think about that person, and you think, there go I, but for the grace
right.
As well. So it's a good reminder to be grateful and to be cautious up there. They moved his body, I think, last year a little bit off the trail, so you no longer can see it. And if I ever were to climb Everest again, I would be a little bit sad going by there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's also probably a good warning. Like, hey, yes. This guy was really experienced and he died here. So just maybe...
It can happen to anyone.
Maybe don't take off without your group and bring a radio when you do.
Right.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. I know even the Sherpas, those guys, there's avalanches. Those guys die all the time. They don't make a ton of money.
Like, no.
You can live on that mountain and still just as easily...
Absolutely.
...have the mountain gods decide to take you that day.
Right.
Is there anything that can keep you warm up there? Is it the cold that's getting to you, or is it just mostly altitude and dehydration?
So the thing is, I never was terribly cold. I got maybe minor frost nip in my fingers and toes, not full frostbite. When you're doing it without oxygen, your blood gets a lot thicker than with it, and you're a lot colder. So what feels warm to someone on it is going to feel a lot colder to someone without it. I was warm enough, and it's really, I think that the altitude compounds the effect of the cold. So, it can be, I mean, it's very cold, but you're also wearing these one piece down suits that are like a sleeping, you're walking around in a sleeping bag. So
yeah, I've seen the photos on your Instagram, and it looks like almost hard to move.
Bunny
in that
suit.
It's a bunny suit. Yeah. It's it seems like still though you're up so high. There's so much wind. There's snow.
Right.
I don't know if it rains. Probably not. It's too high.
Yeah.
But like, there's just no way that you're warm. Every inch of skin that's out has to just be burning.
You have to cover. So you know, you wear like liner gloves so that when you pull your hands out of your mittens to try to take a picture, you don't want them to get flash frozen by the wind.
Crazy.
I don't want to climb when it's so. There's like a rule of thumb for summit day. It's something like no worse than 30 kilometers of wind and no worse than minus 30 centigrade. So I don't know what that is, like maybe, you know, 15 miles an hour, maybe minus 5 or minus 10. And if it's colder and windier than that, which it's, that wouldn't be that cold for Michigan. I mean, it'd be cold, but you could survive.
Yeah.
But you add the altitude and that becomes a, and all that, the clothes you're wearing, it's not wise. And I just have no interest in climbing on, like through conditions worse than that. I'll wait.
I mean, it's hard enough and you're not using oxygen. So it's, you don't have that. It's not, you're not trying to punish yourself. I feel like a lot of these guys that do extreme sports, they're actually trying to punish themselves.
Yeah, there's
almost,
it's maybe particularly in some of the ultra, I think like the ultra marathoning.
Yeah, you know who Dean Karnazes is, for example?
Sure. Yeah.
I think there's an, he's such a nice guy, really interesting dude. I interviewed him a long time ago. There's an element where I think he just likes feeling horrible.
Right. I think there's an addiction to that.
Yeah.
One thing I think mountaineering teaches is the ability to suffer well, but I don't want to take it to the point where, yeah, I'm doing it strictly for the endorphin release of that suffering, which I think that you can get there. So I think that you've made a good observation. Some people do actually sort of get off on, let me actually put myself in this place. Those places can bring a level of introspection and meditation and learning that I think are valuable. So it's a bit of a fine line. And so I would say there is an aspect of this high altitude mountaineering that is where you're putting yourself in a, you know, tough situation to learn more about yourself. For me, I don't do those 100-mile races or 140-mile races through the
desert, the desert. Nevada desert.
Like,
I mean, I remember Dean literally telling me
that
he would like shit himself multiple times.
Yeah.
And he's like, and they say it with like that kind of like, you know, you shit yourself twice. And it's like,
a little,
I don't ever want to do that.
Pride in that.
Yeah. Like, he's like, you know, if you haven't shit yourself twice and while running 50 miles and not sleeping for 3 days, or 150 miles while not sleeping for 3 days, like you, you're not up there with like me and Rich Roll. And I'm like, okay, I don't need to be up there with you and Rich Roll. You guys are crazy.
So it's interesting because I would say I'm sort of on the borderline of that. I do want to learn what about myself when I'm pushing my limits, but I don't, you know, I'm probably biased or blinded. So I don't know, maybe I am crazy too, just at a different degree than some of those ultra marathon guys. But I think there is some level of transcendence or something that can come from finding those edges.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say at the end of like a summit day on Everest, walking back into camp, finding out, feeling my batteries as depleted, my personal like body energy source as depleted as ever. There was some probably euphoria at coming back to camp at that. I actually have an interesting quote that what you say reminds me of. A famous climber named Mark Twight talked about what he was seeking in personal, I guess, revelation in climbing. And he wrote, "We value duration over intensity because the long route insists on introspection and self-analysis. For ourselves, success on the short, intense route left too much downtime to start to believe our own bullshit. So we went long. When 24 hours nonstop wasn't enough, we went longer. When 40 hours only hinted at lessons available to those who would invest more, we went longer again. Finally, after 63 hours on the go, and in the days and months that followed, we realized we had found what we were looking for. That's intense.
Yeah.
That's taking it to a really, really wild level. But when I read that quote, I was just like, wow, there's something there.
Hey, man, I know we have so much more we could talk about. Definitely have to have you back. But thank you so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. It's been really enjoyable. And I agree, there's a lot more. The mountains have a lot of beautiful lessons to impart. So I hope I can share some of those.
There was so much more. I wish we could have gone even longer. This guy is just madness. He is really, really good at what he does. He wanted me to note that no one ever needs to do Everest or K2 or any mountain without oxygen if that's not the idea that consumes them, and it consumed him. So if you're not obsessed with it, don't do it. That's his advice. And that you didn't really need to convince me, David. I wasn't aiming at it, but thank you. And he did manage to summit K2 this time. He just got back. By the time you're listening to it, he's been back for just a day or two. And so he managed to make it to the top. Very incredible. It was awesome to see the photos almost live as it was happening. And it's just incredible. I want to see what's next with him. We got to have him back on the show. Let me know what you think of this one, because this was a little bit outside of our normal fare. But I just had to wrap my mind around this guy's work ethic, fitness level, so much going on with him. What a good dude to boot. So thanks to David Roski for that. We'll link to him in the show notes, his Instagram, if you want to follow his adventures. I'm teaching you how to connect with great people like David Roski, manage relationships using systems and tiny habits. That's in our 6-minute networking course, which is free. That's at jordanharbinger.com/course. A lot of people go, oh, well, what's the price later? It's just free. I literally don't even have my stuff together enough to sell you anything right now with the baby and everything. There's no upsell. The course is complete. You don't get halfway through and have to put in your credit card. It's just free. The world's a better place for you knowing this stuff. jordanharbinger.com/course. And don't say you're going to do it later. You got to dig the well before you're thirsty. Once you need relationships, it's too late to leverage them. This is the stuff I wish I knew 20 years ago. And it takes 6 minutes a day. All right, it takes like 5, but that name was already taken. jordanharbinger.com/course. And by the way, most of the guests on the show actually subscribe to the course and the newsletter. So come join us. Speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway here from David Roski. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. There's a video of this interview on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube. And I read everything, especially the reviews. So review us on Apple Podcasts, please, so others can find the show. Instructions for that, jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. This show is produced in association with Podcast One. This episode was co-produced by Jason DeFilippo and Jen Harbinger. Show notes and worksheets by Robert Fogarty. Music by Evan Viola, and I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Our advice and opinions and those of our guests are their own, and yes, I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer, otherwise I'd probably have better advice that was more well-researched. But do your own research before implementing anything you hear on the show. And remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for the show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which should be in every episode. So please share the show with those you love and even those you don't. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen, and we'll see you next time. A lot of folks ask me which podcasts I listen to and recommend. You've heard me recommend Mind Pump over and over. I'm good friends with those guys, and for good reason. Their content's good. They're good people. I've got Sal here from Mind Pump as well. Episode 1027, 3 Steps to Speeding Up Your Metabolism. Everybody wants to do that, man. Where do I begin?
Well, so it's important to understand how to actually speed up your metabolism, because in the context of modern life, a faster metabolism is very beneficial. Now, it might not be beneficial if you're a hunter-gatherer and food is hard to find. You don't necessarily want to have a faster metabolism.
Right.
But in the context of modern life, we don't move much, and food is everywhere, and we can have whatever flavor and texture. And I mean, I could eat Mexican food and Chinese food within 5 minutes of each other. I mean, yeah. I can have whatever
I
want.
And I have done that.
Yeah, sometimes at the same time. So getting a faster metabolism, it just makes getting lean and staying lean easier. And there are steps you can take to making significant increases in your metabolic rate. Of course, one of them is lifting weights, but there is a way to lift weights that does this most effectively. So in that episode, we break down the way to lift weights to specifically speed up your metabolism. We also talk about something called reverse dieting. Believe it or not, when you reduce your calories or increase your calories, you get a metabolic adaptation where your body will start to slow itself down or speed itself up. And if you combine reverse dieting and you do it properly, which we break it all down, with lifting weights properly, then you get this nice boost of metabolic rate that you can maintain afterwards. And then finally, we talk about sleep and its importance in hormone balance and in your metabolic functioning. So that episode, we break all that down.
So here's, how long does it take to adapt? I'm so curious. Do you have any idea of the range of time it takes to change your metabolism?
Your metabolism adapts daily. Now, depends on what type of adaptation you're looking for. If you want to get your metabolism to burn 300 more calories a day on your own, that can be quite individual. I've trained some men who I can do that within a matter of months, like a month and a half. 300 calories a day is a significant amount.
Yeah, that's a bunch.
And I've worked with some people where it could take a very, very long time, especially people who've repeatedly crash dieted in the past or who maybe have had lots of stress and their body is just in that kind of fight or flight state where it wants to hold on to calories. Sometimes it could take a very, very long time. But once you get a fast metabolism, man, it makes things a lot easier.
I always wondered, so this probably isn't why this happens, but whenever I go home to Michigan and my parents buy like ginger ale, Cheetos, like all the junkiest crap that I used to eat as a kid, I will eat like a bag of Cheetos like every day. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to be so fat when I go home. And I fly back to California, lost 5 pounds.
Wow, that's interesting.
And I'm like, oh, maybe it's a metabolism thing, but it can't be. I'm only there for like a week.
Yeah, I wonder if your activity levels go up.
Or it's got to.
If you're not counting the other calories that are thrown on top.
But, it's got to be. Yeah. It's got to be something like that because I will go to Michigan and eat absolute garbage for a whole week and I come back and I'm like, yeah, I lost 4 pounds. This is amazing.
Well, there is, science has shown, there are some studies that show that Cheetos combined with ginger ale has a really not true at all.
Yeah,
don't do
very,
it.
What is it called? It's a catabolic, reaction.
Yeah, it's got thermogenic
effects. Thermogenic effects.
No, it doesn't do that.
That's episode 1027 on Mind Pump. We'll link to that in the show notes.